And into Thursday morning across England and Wales. Once it lifts, the clouds expected to break again and we'll see a settled pattern with some pleasant spring sunshine on offer once more. The only fly in the ointment this week is a weather front just nudging across the top of the high pressure, and that will threaten a little bit of rain into the extreme northwest of Scotland Thursday into Friday. That's your forecast.
Lovely, warm and sunny. Thanks, Louise Lear there at the BBC Weather Centre. Now on Radio 4, our Book of the Week, and once again we follow Gideon Lewis Krause on the Camino Trail, the first of three pilgrimages aimed at shaking him out of his current inertia and to help him appreciate why his rabbi father left the family home. He's with his friend Tom and suspicious of a guidebook called The Brierley, in A Sense of Direction.
We stop for Baca de Ilias in the last town before the Meseta, the high, hot, featureless plain that takes up the middle 2 weeks of the Camino. The land resembles a vast sea of grain. The Camino appears as a narrow bridge of white gravel to the desolate horizon. Distance is impossible to gauge, and our bodies feel tiny. Colors are pale, drained. Giant cairns of rough white stone are the only built things. On the Meseta, the towns are spaced out and set in clay and hay-specked mud brick, singed bronze by the white sun. Nothing so far has felt quite so medieval as the route must have looked when Ferdinand and Isabella traveled it. We relax in the plaza outside the albergue as the other pilgrims file in. An older man sits down next to us, takes a cigarillo out of an engraved silver box, and asks for a light. He introduces himself as Roman. He's nearing 70 and has done the Camino in sections at least 5 times. I was just telling Tom, I say, that I'm positive I want to do this again. And I was just telling Gideon, Tom says, that he's completely out of his mind. Roman usually walks 2 or 3 weeks each summer. I like the villages, places like here, Ontanas, famous for its local water. The cities are bad. I take buses through them. He's got thin, muscular arms, strong legs, and a tremendous paunch. His right calf is tattooed with a bull, silhouetted against a roseate sunset. He has a mustache and thinned-out gray curls and projects an air of refined corruption. Tom tells him he looks like Gabriel Garcia Marquez. He looks a little bashful, opens his mouth to demur. Sometimes Garcia Marquez, sometimes Al Pacino, he says. By now he's gotten a light for his cigarillo, and he talks through his pluming exhales. There's one thing you can't miss on the Camino. The pulpo a la gallega in Melide. He flutters his fingers like an octopus. We ordinarily stop walking by about 3, after which I'm content to sit and enjoy the sense of an end-of-day accomplishment. And I've noticed that I'm especially able to focus on work, despite my physical exhaustion. I'm more productive in the 2 hours between 4 and 6 p.m. on the Camino than I ever was in an entire week in Berlin. All we're doing is walking and then stopping, but somehow that sense of structure and organization affords me so much productivity and calm. I'm even calm when I think about my dad. When I tell him this, Tom looks at me and squints. Is this walk changing you? In the afternoon of the next day, we arrive at a cafe and drop our stuff. The place looks like a gypsy caravanserai, backpacks in the dust and greasy plates stacked in heaps on the tables. Roman is reclining with a cigarillo, his curls matted to his forehead in the heat as he surveys the table. The best thing about the Camino, he says, and we all lean forward, is the stopping. The walking is bad. But the stopping is so great. The drinks, the chatting, the sitting, the smoking. Like this, now. It's not the walking, we all think. It's the stopping. It seems so obvious now. But there's always an end to the stopping. It's our 20th day, the first day we mostly walk with a group, and thus the beginning of our social epoch. Martin admits he started in Roncesvalles. The rest of us, I tell him, are forever bonded by that miserable, viewless climb of the first day, which means he's not a true pilgrim. He looks hurt, and Tom tells him I'm kidding. Later on, the four of us, abreast on the same hot, straight, boring road, I ask Martin and David if they ever wonder in a late afternoon hour like this, the sun unrelenting in our eyes, why they're walking across Spain? When you arrive at Santiago, you are supposed to ask God to forgive you, David says. But I'm thinking maybe it is I who will forgive God. Today is the climb to the Camino's highest point. We're on the trail by 5, moving quickly in the dark, and the 6 or 7 kilometers of ascent are at such a mild gradient that we barely notice the exertion. The landscape is low, purple shrubbery, wild flowers of yellow and amethyst in a thicket of ground cover, shelves of thin shale. This is a popular place for those of unrigorous disposition, or, I suppose, of delicate constitution, to begin. Just before the Cruz de Ferro, an iron cross set into a little pile of devotional rocks at about 1,500 meters. Pilgrims are huddled around it, taking pictures as we walk by. Indifferent. On our way out of Ponferrada, we pass a standard scallop shell waymarker, and there are, as usual, a few rocks placed on top. David asks if we know why pilgrims do this, and of course we don't. Idea is, he says, that you pick up a rock like somebody else's sin, and then you carry this sin for someone for a little while. It is a burden, and you know that somewhere else someone carries your burden for you. Tom and David make fun of this spiritual calculus, but I think it's actually one of the nicer Camino traditions I've heard about. These rituals of travel seem to retain their power, even when they're no longer about belief. I pick up one small sin from the cairn, but it's a little heavier than I expected, and I put it down. I figure I'll find some peccadillo somewhere. Soria is the last legitimate place to begin and still get a Compostela, and we're resenting the crowds in advance. The trail this morning is probably the loveliest of the whole trip, with mossy stone walls running alongside the lane, and overhead a canopy of chestnut and oak. Run-down fences in the fields mark forgotten property lines. There's a lush, relaxed sense of overgrowth and decay. We decide as a group to stop after just over 30 kilometers. We all probably could keep going, but we're anxious to secure beds for the night, and besides, entering the albergue just before us are two German girls David waved to at O Sobrero, the steepest section of the Camino. Nora and Alina are 19 and from Frankfurt. They join us for dinner, and the occasion merits my first beer of the Camino. Alina, who has dreadlocks and a lot of defiant poise, is about to start an internship as a baker. Nora is a redhead with a luminous, bashful smile, and she plans to spend next year as an au pair in Ireland. By the time we all hit our bunks, we've decided to continue along together in the morning. David says everybody calls this part the Galician Gallop. It takes us half an hour to coordinate. The 2 hours either side of dawn this morning are charged with a special intensity. We're all former strangers moving forward at a brash clip, the light rain not so much falling as distilling itself from the mist. We're too tired to talk, too alone with our morning thoughts, and the only sounds are the plinks of our worn sticks in the soft dirt. Alina and I keep perfect pace with each other, matching light footfalls in the damp earth. It feels even more intimate than holding hands. We stop to share a Galician almond cake, a tarta de Santiago, and agree that we will arrive at the cathedral together. After 32 easy kilometers, we arrive in Melide. It's our penultimate day. Over breakfast, we linger and watch the last day of bull running at San Fermin on TV. One guy trips and is trampled in the narrow street by 5 bulls in a row. On the way out of the cafe, we agree that they should combine the running of the bulls with the Tour de France. But there's no consensus on how. Alina and I pull ahead to escape everybody else and talk about her inability to communicate what this has been like to her boyfriend at home. Neither of us has any desire to stop in Arco de Pino, where we've all agreed to spend the night. It's only 20 more kilometers to Santiago, and we know excitement will prevent us from sleeping. At the very end of the day, a few hundred meters from the albergue, rain starts to come down in torrents, and we run along the road, holding hands and can't stop smiling through the deluge. Over breakfast, the cafe is showing the closing festivities at San Fermin, a greatest gorings montage. It's raining, and we linger a little longer than we usually do. Just around the corner is Monte de Gozzo, the first view of Santiago, and we want to see if the skies will clear. This final stretch is an emotional welter. We're all shot through with sad, nervous exhilaration. We fussily reconfigure. Sometimes we walk alone in a long defile, a narrow bridge connecting us to those who have gone before and those who will come after. And sometimes we walk in pairs, each of us making time to walk with each of the others for a while. We cross the city limits into Santiago, take group pictures at the sign, and make our way through the suburbs. Our pace slows, and we find ourselves touching incidentally, casually, holding one another's glances. Now the yellow arrows spray-painted at our feet are captioned with the scrawled word, Cassie. Almost. The old city's alleys are lined with tourist schlock, souvenir walking sticks, t-shirts with yellow arrows on them. We arrive at the little plaza around the corner from the cathedral. 2 stone stairs run beneath a broad arch to the main square. We stop to make sure we all go through the arch together. Tom and I stand close. "Tom," I say, "it wasn't a race." "It's okay. It was a little bit of a race." Tom hugs me. He's as proud of me as I am of him. We descend the steps past a man playing a Galician bagpipe dirge and come through the arch and into the square and stand before the cathedral, a looming, godly parliament. Paned windows on its block-length facade, all lit in soft patina, give it the look of a Baroque railway station. Other pilgrims file in around us, their heads craned, their pace slow and unsteady. There are, bafflingly, a great many people milling about who did not arrive on foot. We drop our bags from our backs, let them fall behind us where they may, and embrace. We're dumbstruck, and we hold fast to each other. David is crying, and now Tom, and Alina, and now everyone. We sit down on the cool stone, and lean against our heaps of battered bags, and look up at the wide cathedral, and around at the group, and exhale. We swivel around, dazed, overwhelmed, unsure. 500 miles. And now what?
Patrick Kennedy was reading from A Sense of Direction by Gideon Lewis Krauss. The producer was Duncan Minshall. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Wednesday, the 12th of March. There are warnings of gales in Trafalgar, Bailey, Faroes and southeast Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800, high 40s, 1039, expected Poland 1033 by 1800 Wednesday. New high expected Lundy 1031 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking north at Sira, southerly 4 or 5, occasionally 6 in north, fair, moderate or good. South at Sira, variable 3 or 4, fair, moderate or good. 40s Cromarty 4th, south or southwest 4 or 5, fair, moderate or good.